From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. How hard will it be to cover what increasingly seems to be an inevitable war? Indications are very hard. The Iraqi government was angered, apparently, by coverage of a demonstration this week in the streets of Baghdad. The protesters, relatives of prisoners, wanted to know why their loved ones were not among those released in a general amnesty last Sunday.
I want this message to get to Saddam Hussein, she says. Our son was taken in 1991. The interview ends as a government official steps in.
That was CNN's Nick Robertson. The American media coverage of this unprecedented event was not abundant, but it was enough to infuriate the government in Baghdad. So on Thursday, it ordered the expulsion of most foreign journalists who will have to reapply under strict new rules for at most 10-day visas.
This is surprising, not because of the Iraqi response, but maybe because the protest was covered at all. It has long been the case that in order to obtain a visa for Iraq, journalists have had to sell a little of their souls. Or so contends journalist Franklin Foer in a recent New Republic article. Here's why. Most of the Western press bureaus in Baghdad are based in the Ministry of Information. They need signed authorization for anything they film. They are assigned permanent minders who follow them everywhere. Their reports are closely monitored, and if they step out of line, if their stories don't pass muster, their visas are revoked and they are expelled. An old journalistic aphorism holds that access is a curse, notes Franklin Foer. For Western journalists, the Iraqi experience proves it can be much worse than that.
They're trailed constantly. Their hotel rooms are bugged, possibly even with cameras. They're followed constantly, not just by these government minders, but also by secret police. And I contacted Iraqi intelligence officials through the Iraqi opposition, and they laid out to me in extreme details all their mechanisms for undermining the work of Western journalists.
Give me some examples of that.
They described to me how they would sometimes fabricate car crashes in order to create situations where journalists had to get dragged into the police station and might get sent off course. They described to me situations where they would hire Arab Iraqi reporters to befriend Western journalists so that they could learn something about their motives and maybe learn something about their weaknesses. It's all the most Orwellian sort of operation that you could imagine.
And what happens to a reporter who defies the system laid down by Saddam?
Reporters who defy the system at best are not allowed back into the country. At worst, they're harassed and intimidated by the regime. To give you the kind of most vivid example of that, there was a French documentarian named Joel Solaire who has a program coming out on Cinemax next month called Uncle Saddam. And he got tremendous access to the regime, took pictures of the inside of Saddam's palaces and had access to his inner circle. And as soon as they recognized that Solaire was not making a documentary about the horrors of sanctions, his minder took him to a hospital where they arranged for a series of uninvited blood tests for the guy, which he was only able to stave off by creating a scene of hysteria, jumping up on a table, threatening to call his embassy.
So what is the impact, generally, of all these mechanisms on reporting from Iraq?
It depends a lot on the news organizations. The news organizations that are most keen to maintain their access in Iraq let the Iraqis have their way. They broadcast Iraqi propaganda, such as highly contrived anti-American demonstrations, or they go on these highly contrived tours of alleged chemical weapon sites that turn out to be baby milk factories, and they essentially parrot the government line.
So are you suggesting that reporters shouldn't even bother to try to report from Iraq?
I think it really depends. I mean, I think that there are certain news organizations like CNN and the TV networks that are so obsessed with maintaining access that they do pull their punches. But there are others, like the New York Times' John Burns, who I think has done a pretty excellent job at pointing out the ways in which he's being manipulated and controlled by the Iraqi media operation, and has actually been able to elude them and come up with some really interesting, important nuggets about what's going on. But he's the rare, I think, example that proves the rule.
Okay. Thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thanks.
Franklin Foer's article called Air War, How Saddam Manipulates the U.S. Media, appeared earlier this month in the New Republic.
Josh Hammer, a Middle East correspondent for Newsweek based in Jerusalem, has reported from Iraq twice in the last year. He says that TV reporters have it tougher than their colleagues in print.
How many people who are put on camera in Iraq are going to say anything like the people that I spoke to, condemning the regime, talking about torture, talking about the brutality, using some really strong language? Nobody's going to get up in front of a television camera and say that sort of stuff. So TV reporters are constrained on the one hand by the fact that they want to get visas, that they want to maintain, you know, decent relations with the regime, and then on the other hand by there's simply an information vacuum inside Iraq.
But that doesn't mean print reporters pass under the radar of the Iraqi authorities. By no means.
So I wrote a couple of pieces on my last visit in April. I wrote a story for Newsweek, a fairly prominent long piece that was fairly restrained. But I also wrote a piece for the website in which I interviewed a few people without my government minder who were saying some pretty damning things about Saddam Hussein and his sons. And my understanding is I'm now on the blacklist. I couldn't get another visa if I wanted to. They're not just reading a hard copy, they're scanning websites, you know, and seeing what you're writing about them on the web as well as in print.
But if the situation is as Franklin Foer describes, that reporters are accepting extraordinary restrictions, choosing their battles, so to speak, the question is that a valid journalistic choice?
No, I think it's a dreadful tactic. I think self-censorship is a big mistake. I don't want to go out on a limb and say in every single situation. Clearly, you don't want to be in the position of being locked out. But I would argue that the Iraqi regime has as much interest in keeping the American networks present there as the international networks have in being there. Look, quite frankly, the best information about Iraq is not going to be acquired from inside the country, paradoxically enough. You're so controlled. There's so much fear. You can't interview top government officials, frankly. You can't interview people in the streets. So where's your best material going to come from? It's going to come from exiles. It's going to come from people who've left the country. It's going to come from people who are no longer under the constraint of the Iraqi dictatorship to speak about what's going on. So, okay, maybe inside the country your people are bending over backwards not to avoid irritating the regime too much or to avoid being put on the blacklist. But, I mean, I've worked there a couple of times, and there's just not a whole lot to be learned.
That was Josh Hammer, a Middle East correspondent for Newsweek based in Jerusalem. After journalists were expelled from Iraq on Thursday, CNN head of news gathering Eason Jordan called the move a draconian measure that will sharply curtail the world's knowledge about what is happening in Iraq. Iraq is often displeased with CNN, says Jordan, but especially this week when the network reported from the scene of that extraordinary protest in Baghdad.
The big beef was that we reported that gunfire was used to disperse the demonstrators, which is absolutely irrefutable fact. But the Iraqi government sometimes denies the facts and refuses to acknowledge the truth.
Well, what kind of weird conversation is it with the Iraqi officials that you're having when you're holding up a piece of videotape and saying, this is black, and they're saying, no, no, that's white? It's bizarre.
Well, there are a lot of bizarre things in Iraq, and unfortunately, the Iraqi officials refused to look at the videotape because they said they didn't care what it showed or what was heard on the tape, because the reality, the Iraqi reality, was very different from the actual facts.
I'm sure you have seen Franklin Foer's article in the New Republic, which charges that the Western press is appeasing the Iraqi regime in order to maintain its visas to be there reporting should a war ultimately break out. What's your take on that?
The writer clearly doesn't have a clear understanding of the realities on the ground, because CNN has demonstrated again and again that it has a spine, that it's prepared to be forthright, is forthright in its reporting. We wouldn't have a team in northern Iraq right now if we didn't want to upset the Saddam Hussein regime. We wouldn't report on the demonstration if we didn't want to upset the Saddam Hussein regime. We wouldn't have been thrown out of Iraq already 5 times over the last several years if we were there to please the Saddam Hussein regime. So the story was lopsided, unfair, and chose to ignore facts. It would refute the premise of the article.
Well, what is the calculus in the New Republic article? He cited the coverage of Saddam Hussein's birthday by CNN, which he deemed to be not a huge news event. Are you tossing bones to Saddam Hussein in order to be there when it really matters?
No, I don't think that's the case at all. Now, there is Iraqi propaganda that is news. I mean, there is propaganda from a lot of governments around the world that is newsworthy, and we should report on those things. Saddam Hussein's birthday is a big deal in that country. We're not reading Iraqi propaganda. We're reporting as an independent news organization.
Back in 91, CNN and Peter Arnett in particular were heavily criticized, mostly by civilians, for reporting from within Baghdad during the U.S. attack in ways that they'd considered to be utter propaganda and out of context and not reflecting the overall reality of the Saddam Hussein regime. Have you analyzed what you can get access to without appearing to be just a propaganda tool for Saddam?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we work very hard to report forthrightly, to report fairly, and to report accurately. And if we ever determine we cannot do that, then we would not want to be there. But we do think that some light is better than no light whatsoever. I think that the world, the American people, will be shortchanged if foreign journalists are kicked out, because even in Peter Arnett's case, there were things that he reported on, and this is a long time ago now, but things he reported on that I don't think would have been reported at all had he not been there. We feel committed to our Baghdad presence. We've had a bureau there for 12 years with occasional interruptions when we've been thrown out. But we're not there to please the Iraqi government. We're not there to displease the Iraqi government. We're just there to do our job.
Let's say there's a second Gulf War. Is that the mother of all stories? Do you have to be there? Are there decisions you'll make on the margins to be as certain as you possibly can that you will have a presence there?
We'd very much like to be there if there's a second war, but we are not going to make journalistic compromises in an effort to make that happen, being mindful that in wartime there's censorship on all sides, and we're prepared to deal with a certain amount of censorship as long as it's not extreme, ridiculous censorship, which we've actually seen in a number of cases in previous conflicts, not just with Iraq. But sure, we want to be there, but we don't want to be there come hell or high water. We want to be there if we can be there and operate as a responsible news organization.
Very well. Eason Jordan, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Eason Jordan is the chief news executive and news gathering president for CNN News Group. He joined us from CNN studios in Atlanta.
Coming up, a morbid assignment in Rome and a second life for rejected sitcoms in cabaret bars.
This is On the Media from NPR. We are back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In Rome, the eyes of the world are focused on Pope John Paul II. The 82-year-old pontiff suffers from Parkinson's disease and is showing signs of fatigue. For Vatican experts and landlords around St. Peter's, this is providing a boon of sorts. Television networks are bidding huge sums of money for a prime view of St. Peter's, and Vatican experts are signing lucrative contracts to provide hours of commentary. Megan Williams reports from Rome on how the media prepare for the death of a pope.
It's not something the Vatican or media outlets want to talk about. But for the past several years, preparations for the pope's death have been moving along at a fast clip. Television networks from around the world have been caught in bidding wars for balconies that provide the prized shot of St. Peter's Square. When the pope dies, the cardinals gather in the Sistine Chapel to elect a new one. Once he's chosen, a plume of black smoke lifting out of St. Peter's will turn white. This is to let the world know there's a new pope. And it's the shot that TV networks are willing to pay a lot of money for. Robert Mickens is a Vatican specialist. He's covered the Pope for the past 10 years, much of that at Vatican Radio. Mickens says that all the nervous gearing up for the Pope's death has been going on for about a decade. But with each passing year, the tension increases, along with the price the networks are paying to secure a good shot of St. Peter's.
Right from the very beginning, I mean, already back in 93, this whole thing, the Death Watch started, and people, the news networks, big media, started looking for spaces to do their setup for the whole event, which is going to be a couple of weeks long from the time he dies, the funeral, and then the conclave. Because, I mean, this is a whole package deal, and they want to be on site for that. So you've got people that already were paying a yearly deposit just to reserve a balcony or a rooftop of a nice hotel with St. Peter's in the background for that day when the Pope is sick and dies so they can set up.
Networks themselves won't disclose how much they're paying, nor will landlords who have been sworn to secrecy. But Tommaso De Benedetti, a journalist for the Italian daily Il Mattino, says that most of the balconies are going for hundreds of thousands of dollars. And one that directly overlooks St. Peter's Square has gone to a major U.S. network for a whole lot more.
One network pays $2 million for 3 days of a balcony. The balcony is looking over St. Peter's Square. Cost $2 million for 3 days. And that is sure.
But the preparations don't stop with location. Media networks are lining up Vatican experts to provide round-the-clock commentary during the funeral and conclave.
It will be near 9/11 in terms of levels of coverage, but not just in the States, but internationally. I mean, it becomes the biggest story in the world for roughly a month. And obviously, you know, media outlets want to be ready for it.
John Allen is author of the recently published book called The Conclave. He's also just signed a hefty contract with CNN to be its commentator during the funeral and conclave. He says true Vatican experts like himself are few and far between. It's a difficult beat to cover. The Vatican is renowned for its arcane language and bureaucracy, as well as blocking access to the media. So people like Allen, who know their way around, come at a premium.
To put it crassly, we have a seller's market these days for Vatican expertise because, you know, people are obviously fascinated by the question of what might happen when this pope dies. Who might be the next pope and how will that pope get chosen and how does this mysterious centuries-old process really work? And what are the politics, you know, beneath the smoke and mirrors? And so what it has meant is that I find myself much busier than I was at this time, say, 2 years ago.
Not only are experts like Allen being called upon to comment, most have lucrative book contracts. Allen himself will have to turn around a biography of the new pope within weeks. He says he's done his homework and isn't worried about pulling it off, but he is concerned about all the competition.
I can speak with confidence in the English-speaking world. Every publisher I know has someone lined up to do a biography of the new pope when it happens. So there will be a flood of these titles. And the logic there is there will be a few months when anything with the new pope's picture on it is going to fly off shelves.
And a number of publishers have already hedged their bets by putting out books before the pope has died. Even John Allen has a section in The Conclave outlining the top contenders for the job. This is risky. Several on his list died as the book was being printed. And as Robert Mickens points out, so far this pope has defied the odds.
And then the whole thing just is, as his health has deteriorated, people have been making this guessing game. I think it's interesting that Peter Hebblethwaite wrote a book right around the same time called The Next Pope. Well, Peter Hebblethwaite died. And so, I mean, the Pope should have wrote a book called The Next Hebblethwaite, and it would have made more sense.
Qui fecit celum et terra.
Benedicat vos, omnipotens Deus, Pater et Filius, et Sanctus.
Amen.
For On the Media, this is Megan Williams in Rome.
Among the headlines on the obituary page this week, Richard Helms, ex-CIA chief, Jesse Greenstein, astronomer, Adolph Green, Broadway playwright, Derek Bell, Celtic harpist. It doesn't require a pope to make a great obituary, just a life fully lived and the right person to tell it. That's what producer David Isay found more than a dozen years ago when he dropped in on the obit writing staff of the New York Times.
It's 5 p.m., deadline hour in the massive newsroom, which has occupied the third floor of the New York Times building in Times Square since it opened back in 1913. In one corner of the newsroom, tucked behind the financial desk, sits the seven-person New York Times obituary staff. While some of these obituary writers occupy themselves with the day-to-day reporting of deaths, a number devote the majority of their time to penning obituaries for people who have yet to die. People deemed worthy of a more thoughtful last word in this, the paper of record, than what might be written on Deadline. There's no other job like it in the entire country.
This is a celebration of life, of achievement, of one special person.
Peter Flint has been writing advance obituaries at the Times for 12 years.
This is the top drawer of the files of the advance obits that I've written. And it's I have, say, the first four or five that are being edited and that I may be called on to answer questions on. And after that, we get to the other subjects alphabetically.
In four locked drawers are stored the hundreds of advance obituaries filed from A to Z, which Peter Flint has written. They're directors, actors, writers, social scientists, historians. All are well known. All are alive. Each obituary, printed on computer paper with holes running down the sides, begins with a simple lead sentence. The first half gives a concise summary of the person's life. The second half reads, died blank. He or she was blank years old. The advance obituary staff call the subjects of these files their clients. For the sake of good taste, the Times keeps the names of these clients confidential. While Peter Flint has the hundreds of advance obituaries he's written at his fingertips, in the morgue or reference center of the Times, in two unmarked padlocked file cabinets, are what's thought to be thousands more, although no one's ever counted. But even with the large number of advance obituaries already written, it's still a struggle to try and ensure that all major figures are covered when their time comes. So what's the trick? Peter Flint.
My wife is intuitive about these things. We'll be having supper, and all of a sudden she'll look up and say a name. It won't be really any inspiration from a radio or television or a book. It'll just be, you know, all of a sudden the name appears. And I'll jot down the name as soon as possible and write it.
Flint's wife, Marianne, has a knack for picking clients. She blurted out Joan Crawford's name over dessert one night only 2 weeks before she died. She came almost as close with Hitchcock. Once a client is chosen, the writers will take anywhere from 2 days to a number of weeks to compose the obituary. Each writer has a personal information-gathering style.
The fun part, I think, is interviewing the subjects.
Marilyn Berger, who actor John Houseman once referred to as the angel of death from the New York Times.
I'll call and say, I'd like to take you to lunch, or I'd like to see you, or I'd like an appointment. I'm from the New York Times, and I'm doing a story about you. Then if they say, what's the story for? I say, well, I'd rather talk to you about it when I see you.
Peter Flint prefers to rely on biographies and newspaper clippings when penning the obituaries of his clients.
The great majority of people really don't like to speak to an advance obituary writer. It makes most people uneasy. And they're almost, you know, conscious of, you know, my golly, I'm saying something here, and it's going to appear after I am dead. It makes them uncomfortable. Some are superstitious. I mean, the fact that, I mean, this man has arrived at your home. And I just really don't want to think about this. I mean, even though I know it's inevitable.
The only other inevitable involving the obituary staff is that no one is permitted to see his or her own obituary, not even Times publisher Punch Sulzberger. Times have changed for the advance obituary staff. Some of the legendary advance writers like Alden Whitman and Al Krebs have retired. Years ago, the New York Times put an end to what was known as the Ghoul Pool, where advance obit writers would wager on the date that an obituary would finally make it into print. But there's a spirit among these advance obituary writers which lives on, a pride in ensuring that important figures get the farewell they deserve, in knowing that they will go out with a flourish in the paper of record.
I don't want to sound like a ghoul, but it's a joy to try to capture as neatly and as gracefully, as effectively as possible, the essence of a special human being. And that's my obligation, and that's what I strive for. August 13th, 1982. Henry Fonda, who exemplified for nearly half a century a man of honesty and decency in more than 100 films and stage plays, died early yesterday of chronic heart disease in Los Angeles. He was 77 years old. The actor, who retained a boyish candor and a gentle but firm manner, had long been a quintessential American hero. His image of a prairie Galahad was enhanced by his clean-cut features and firm jaw, tall, lean frame, loping stride, and dry wit, expressed with a distinctive Middle Western twang. Mr. Fonda was a meticulous and modest craftsman, dedicated and intense, who thoroughly enjoyed his profession. Mr. Fonda really lived when he was acting and just existed when he wasn't. He remarked, quote, "If I project anything of me into my roles, it's maybe a man with some dignity who tries to be honest," unquote, and that, quote, "I just want to be remembered as a good actor," unquote. Besides his wife and children, he survived by 4 grandchildren and a sister.
David Isay, executive producer of Sound Portraits, did this piece in 1989. Obit writer Marilyn Berger retired from the Times this year. Peter Flint, who read from his obituary of Henry Fonda, has since himself died. We couldn't find his obituary.
Here's a funny ABC sitcom called The Funkhousers. In this scene, the youngest Funkhouser watches cable television with the neighbor boy.
You want to watch something dirty?
Sure.
Hey, how about that one?
Sex and the City.
Yeah, at least half it's going to be about sex.
Yeah, and we can flip around during the city parts.
Come on, sweetie. You know you want it.
And I did, but I'd never done anything so immoral, so deliciously decadent. Did I dare? Spend 2 months' salary on a belt?
Forget it. Let's watch something else.
Shh! Want to see if she buys a belt.
The thing is, the Funkhousers will never be seen, at least on television, but it's being shown as part of a live theater experience called The Other Network. It's a venue for rejected sitcom pilots that plays at the Bar Moomba in Los Angeles most Fridays. This weekend, the show moved to the Knitting Factory in New York City. Two former writers and producers for The Simpsons, Bill Oakley and Josh Weinstein, created The Funkhousers and another rejected sitcom, both of which have been featured on The Other Network. Bill, welcome.
Thank you.
And Josh, welcome to you, too.
Hi, thanks.
So, once a network passes on a sitcom you've worked on, you can't rewrite, you can't reshoot, you can't recast. You've had your chance, and now you just have to accept it.
Bingo. Maybe one or two in the history of television in the last 20 years. One or two pilots have possibly been shot by one network and then picked up by another. The six networks order about 500 scripts between them. Then they shoot about 90 pilots, and then about 20 make it to air. This is just for comedies. They're, you know, of those 90 that are shot, 70 never see the light of day.
And we, in fact, had always been saying to ourselves, boy, if someone went to every good writer in Hollywood and said, give us your best unpicked-up pilot, you would have a great TV network. You'd probably have the number one TV network. So we're very grateful that at least people are trying.
Right. It's not actually a broadcast network, but a room of people in a bar is just as fun.
Do you or your friends who are part of the other network see the live show as a chance for vindication so you can say, see, it was funny?
Yeah. In fact, it's a way to give a show a sort of decent burial, as opposed to sort of being shuffled off to oblivion.
Being lost at sea.
Right.
Yes. Now we know where the corpse is, and we get to bury it with a decent funeral.
Right. And it is. It's very satisfying because we actually, in front of, which you don't actually have when you have a TV show on the air, is you're sitting in front of like 200 people, and they're actually laughing. So it is, it's sort of a very, it's a very sweet death.
This week, The Other Network is coming to the Knitting Factory here in New York. And as we mentioned, usually it plays at a club called Moomba in Los Angeles. Is anyone hoping for a miracle that the live performance proves so successful that the show has another chance?
I think that would be our wildest dream come true if some network executive were to walk in and see this and say, that show's great, I got to buy it and put it on. But they don't seem to be the type of people who attend these events.
Yes, if ever like a 20-year-old drunken college student is running a network, then we're
We got three or four shows on the air immediately.
Now, leaving your two projects out for a moment, have you seen anything on the other network that just sent you over the moon? You thought, this is my favorite project, my favorite rejected project.
There's one show which I believe will be showing in New York called Look Well, which is a show that Conan O'Brien did with Robert Smigel back when we were on The Simpsons with Conan in the early 90s. It stars Adam West, who you'll remember as Batman, and Adam West plays a sort of a washed-up detective show actor who sort of thinks he's really a crime fighter. And
meddles in all the police's affairs.
Yes, and that show is so funny. I think that may be one of the shows that is the all-time great example of an unpicked-up pilot. Unfortunately, I can see how the show is really, really works in a sort of ironic world, and I think a lot of people don't get that type of humor.
But you know what's really amazing to me is that when you have names like Conan O'Brien or Robert Smigel or Bob Odenkirk or Ben Stiller or Jack Black or you two guys attached to a project that some network executive wouldn't say, okay, I trust you. You're funny. Here, take your chance.
You know what? They do that in ordering the pilots. They just don't put them on the air. That's why all these people have gotten pilots, and they continue to do so, including us. We're doing pilots right now for next season. I mean, I can expound on my own personal theory. What you've just said, the people you've just listed are all hilarious comedians who sort of work in a sort of alternative type of comedy. This is a country with nearly 300 million people, and I think that type of humor doesn't attract more than 20 or 30% of the audience in any given time.
And yet The Simpsons right. is widely regarded as the best and longest-running comedy in the country.
Right, because that sort of hit it on all magical levels, where it appeals to the very small audience that likes, you know, jokes about President Garfield, which is about 0.01% of the audience. But it also appeals to people who like to see, you know, Homer get hit on the head with a videotape.
Unfortunately, the nature of television is such that to be a big hit like that, you really have got to work on all the levels, whereas these other shows that you're talking about, including our shows and our failed pilots, seem to only attract a small portion of the audience.
Right. It seems eventually the people who grew up watching The Simpsons will be running the networks, and if we can last that long, we'll be okay.
I want to thank you both very much.
You're welcome, and thank you. And if any network executives are listening to this, please attend the other network in New York or Los Angeles. Watch our pilots and pick them up.
And you will soon become the head of your corporation.
Bill Oakley and Josh Weinstein are comedy writers and contributors to The Other Network, seen most Fridays at Moomba in Los Angeles and this weekend at the Knitting Factory in New York City.
Coming up, a peek inside the campaign bus of candidate George Bush and a look at a public relations whiz kid named Jesse James.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When Texas Governor George W. Bush went out on the stump to run for president, the press, as always, tagged along in chartered planes and buses led from one staged event to another for the message of the day and photo ops galore. The bubble, they call it, that strangely insulated netherworld between journalism and reality. One person in the bubble was an NBC producer named Alexandra Pelosi, who also happens to be the daughter of House Democratic Whip Nancy Pelosi of California. A liberal Democrat like Mom, Alexandra filled 18 months full of idle hours taping conservative Republican Bush and her colleagues with a digital camcorder. What began as a personal keepsake has become a full-length documentary, which debuts on HBO November 5th. The film, which she insists on calling a home movie, is titled Journeys with George, and the home movie maker joins me now. Alexandra, welcome to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
Now, let's talk about your home movie. What gave you this idea?
I was assigned to go on the campaign trail with George W. Bush for NBC News, and I brought my video camera along, just like you'd bring your camera along if you went on vacation with your family. And I just started shooting interviews with my seatmates, video of myself eating my turkey sandwiches, you know, that kind of stuff. And Bush saw me shooting in the back of the room, and I think he decided he would rather be the star of the movie than the butt of the joke. So he came up and he started engaging with me. And then one day he said, what are you going to call this movie that you're making? And I said, I don't know. What do you think we should call it? And he said, how about Journeys with George? And that's when I knew I had a movie and that I had to really start shooting for real. So it was definitely the accidental documentary.
There's a couple pieces of tape that I couldn't decide whether they were just kind of amusing and adorable or just plain creepy. The president took an either jocular or perverse interest in your romantic life.
I saw you walking along a secluded road the other day with a Newsweek man. Now, it's none of my business what your private life is like, but let me ask you this question. Was that just a social encounter with Newsweek man?
That was strictly professional.
Professional. And you felt like you had to hold his hand in order to be able to have that amplify the discussion.
What I think is interesting about George Bush's interest in my love life on the campaign trail is that it reveals his strategy in handling opposition. George Bush had never met anyone like me. I was this, you know, sort of liberal, young, purple-wearing woman from San Francisco. You know, all, the women in his life are these delicate Southern belles, i.e. Laura. So the fact that he was sitting me down and basically saying, we need to find you a husband, all very revealing about the way he handles people.
Well, that brings us to another chilling moment in Journeys with George, in which you have a little epiphany. The scene is your birthday, and you get a cake, not from your colleagues in the bubble, nor from NBC News in New York, but from the campaign. Let's listen to that.
At first, I didn't even think about how all these birthday parties could affect my objectivity as a journalist. But by the time the Bush campaign brought me my fourth birthday cake and no one from my network called, I did start to wonder, who am I working for?
So who were you working for, Alexandra?
You know, I was working for NBC News, and I was also, in a way, you know, helping the Bush campaign put their images out. And, you know, that I always felt that there was some strain. You know, you get a little too close, and that's part of the conflict of PAC journalism.
Well, if there's any overarching theme in Journeys with George, and it's certainly the message that you draw from it, whether it was your intention to say it or not, that life within the bubble is a kind of unreality that does not reflect the true issues going on in the campaign, and that the journalism that takes place isn't really much journalism at all.
No, no, no. PAC journalism isn't supposed to be journalism. It's supposed to be, we're the babysitters. We are the people who are on body watch. When there's journalism to be committed, the big shots come in. Tom Brokaw will show up and he'll do the story of the day. I wasn't there as a journalist. I was there as a facilitator for NBC News. And I don't think anyone at NBC was disappointed at the revelation that there was no journalism inside the bubble. They know that. Just because there's no journalism inside the bubble doesn't mean that there's no journalism in America on a presidential campaign. You can still have Frank Bruni from the New York Times inside the bubble reporting his stories and then have Adam Clymer from the New York Times writing stories that they refer to him as a major league asshole after he writes his story. You know, I mean, it's not as if I'm saying no journalism is committed in America and in presidential politics. I'm just saying inside the bubble.
Which leads to the question. So tell me again why we need the bubble.
We need the bubble because NBC needs images of the presidential candidate that day. NBC needs an on-the-bus librarian. They can call up in 1 second and say, when was the last time Bush talked about partial birth abortions? When was the last time Bush talked about gun control? I was the in-house expert. So that when the campaign became my friends and had birthday parties for me and no one from NBC knew who I was, it wasn't, you know, any great egregious violation of all the codes of journalism because NBC sent me in with that intention. My job was to go in behind enemy lines and retrieve all of the images of the day.
About 25 years ago, the book The Boys in the Bus came out, and it was similarly themed and similarly constructed and similarly horrifying about the process of covering presidential race. And nothing really changed except that it's just gotten lots worse. Do you have any hopes at all that this film will in any way change the way major news organizations and especially the TV networks cover politics in the United States?
They don't have a choice. There are too many cable outlets. There's the internet. The next time around, these digital cameras, these $1,000 digital cameras, will be out there. The technology is going to change the political campaigns, whether they like it or not. You know, campaigns are a surreal circus, and I'm going to be out there in 2004 with my handheld camera, and I am going to be shooting more of this stuff and deconstructing political campaigns and trying to get that on television.
All right. Well, Alexandra Pelosi, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alexandra Pelosi is the reporter, director, and producer of Journeys with George, which will air on HBO the week of November 5th, the midterm elections.
I'm on the road, trying to keep on course. I'm on a journey with George.
Recently, in order to understand the mindset of the then-unknown D.C. snipers, Fox News Channel's Rita Crosby wrote to the imprisoned serial killer David Berkowitz, a.k.a. Son of Sam. "I believe as a Christian, your help is a great service," she wrote. "You have a testimony that must be heard." Crosby made no apology for her appeal, and in fact there is a journalistic tradition of writing fawning letters to mass murderers. Case in point, last year the University of Michigan Special Collections Library made available some letters written to Ted Kaczynski, a.k.a. the Unabomber.
These letters were from major media operations, and some, how to put this delicately, shamelessly shoveled the guano like there was no tomorrow. And though this is completely unfair to people who, after all, are just doing their jobs, we'd like to share a few with you. A producer from 60 Minutes 2 on CBS wrote, "Excuse me for being blunt, but several doctors and some of your lawyers have claimed you suffer from schizophrenia. I want to give you the opportunity to respond point by point to their allegations and to show the American people that you are, in fact, rational, clear-headed, and sane." A correspondent from ABC's Good Morning America pointed out that he was uniquely equipped for an interview because, quote, "I was born not far from where you now live," he tactfully leaves out, "in prison, and have a cabin in the woods west of Colorado Springs that has no electricity or running water." And this from The Roseanne Show, which did not last long despite the unbridled enthusiasm of this producer who wrote, "If you know anything about Roseanne, you must know that she is a nonconformist and rarely does what society expects of her. I believe you and her would definitely hit it off and the conversation would definitely be interesting and fulfilling for both of you." Ted Kaczynski remained unfulfilled and never granted any of them an interview. Some people just don't understand the importance of a free press. With good PR, you can change just about anything into something else. Good PR can turn cigarettes from coffin nails into icons of cool. The right spin can turn murderous thugs into crusading Avengers. Jesse's story begins in Civil War, Missouri, a border state, not divided neatly by a Mason-Dixon line, but ripped raggedly apart, neighbor against neighbor. Then he was a bushwhacker, fighting for the Confederacy outside the regular army, killing civilian unionists and Republicans on their doorsteps. After the war, he was just a murderous thug, but he captured the imagination of unrepentant Confederate newspaper man John Edwards, and together they reshaped his image into a gunslinging, train-robbing, underdog-defending superhero of the Southern cause. T.J. Stiles, author of the new biography Jesse James, Last Rebel of the Civil War, says the legend of Jesse James is as complicated as it is enduring, a perfect case study in media management.
Really, the story of Jesse James in the media comes in two waves. And the second wave that we're more familiar with is the popular entertainment wave, in which he's seen as sort of a proto-progressive Robin Hood, a man who stood up for the small farmer against the railroads and who never killed except for in self-defense and things like that. And there have been a number of novels and movies that have sort of depicted him in this light. As a matter of fact, the horrible movie that came out about a year ago, American Outlaws, depicted the James and younger brothers as the enemies of the rapacious railroads.
This isn't a feud, this is war. They've got more men than we do.
So what do, generally?
We do what we did in the war. We harass their supply lines. If you try and kill the railroads, man, they won't care.
But if we take away their money and supplies...
Exactly.
That's a good plan, Jesse.
And this is sort of the second wave that we're familiar with. But more interesting to me is the first wave, the original role of Jesse James in the media, which was the fact that he was polarizing and dividing the people in his own community. He was rallying one element of this bitterly divided community against another, that is, the former Confederates against the former Unionists. Jesse James and his brother took part in these savage atrocities, and yet his supporters at the time, including John Edwards, this newspaper editor who was so important in helping Jesse promote himself in the press, wrote editorials that explicitly praised the atrocities that Jesse and his fellow guerrillas had taken part in.
In glorifying the exploits of the James brothers, John Edwards wrote the concisely titled Chivalry of Crime.
That's right. It was a routine they carried out throughout the 1870s. Edwards would write an editorial saying, whoever carried out these deeds are former Confederate guerrillas and they're amazingly brave men, and their deeds must be contrasted with the corruption of the radical Republican administration in Washington. Then would follow a letter from Jesse James. He would say, I know that the radical Republicans think that I'm guilty of this. I don't care whether they think I'm guilty or not. However, I'm innocent, but there's no point in proving my innocence.
Beyond writing letters to the editor, what else did he do to attract press coverage?
He craved attention, and at least on two occasions he left behind press releases at the scenes of his robberies.
Didn't he also go so far as to endorse a presidential candidate in one of his letters?
That's correct. In his most famous letter in 1872, one that's often quoted because it says, we rob the rich for the poor, it was actually, if you read that statement in full context, that was a part of an attack on the Grant administration. And he was saying that the Grant administration robs poor and rich alike. At least we rob the rich and give to the poor. And he said, I will close by asking my readers to vote for Horace Greeley to defeat Grant.
Now, by the way, for the sake of clarity, there is no indication that Jesse James ever gave one red cent to the poor, except perhaps in heavy tipping in bars. Isn't that true?
That's correct. He was a heavy gambler, and at best, he paid handsomely when he stopped at a farmhouse anonymously for a night's rest and for a meal. That's about as close as he came to ever giving money to the poor.
So all of this was working swimmingly between Jesse's letters and Edwards' editorials and even other like-minded papers who bought hook, line, and sinker, the Robin Hood image for Jesse James. At some point, the strategy stopped working, and he became very quickly nothing more than a common criminal.
Well, the climax came in 1876 when Jesse James embarked on this ambitious robbery to Northfield, Minnesota, his most famous robbery in which eventually the entire gang was shot to pieces and only the two James brothers escaped. And afterwards, the brothers retreated to Nashville, where they lived quietly for 3 years. Jesse James returned to his criminal role 3 years after the Northfield raid, but his political role had disappeared. So he still craved attention. His first train robbery, he left a press release behind in 1879. It was his first robbery after Northfield 3 years later. And yet there was no political context anymore. The whole struggle over the Civil War and Reconstruction had been so bitter in Missouri, was eventually won by the Confederates, which is what Jesse James's goal was all along. By 1879, both U.S. senators from Missouri were former Confederates. You had former Confederates as congressmen from Missouri. So Jesse James was undone by his victory, and there was no more place for him. So he stopped writing letters to the press. There ceased to be so many editorials in support of him. All the old newspapers that had once supported him now depicted him as simply a criminal who'd outlived his usefulness.
Jesse James died in truly the cinematic tradition, shot by one of his own men for money. How did the press cover his death?
This shocking act of treachery of his assassination by one of his last two followers, who had conspired with the governor of Missouri to bring him down, really shocked the conscience of Missourians. And the newspapers really took the governor to task for this. It created enough public sympathy to allow Frank James to be acquitted and live quietly for the rest of his life. And it sort of cleared the way for Jesse James's second act in the media, the life of the completely unpolitical man who was the defender of the small farmer against the rapacious railroads, a role he'd never played during his life.
I think at this point it's probably worth noting that James himself and a number of the other people he followed were psychotic. They enthusiastically practiced scalping. During his first train robbery, he used the mask of the then popular nascent Ku Klux Klan to intimidate the passengers. These were anything but noble savages, but merely savages. Why does he have such a hold on the American imagination 120 years after his death?
There's a question of a need that people have, that American culture has, for a rebel, for someone who resists the powers that be. And so we have this image of Jesse as this heroic, defiant figure. And yet we've forgotten what he was defying. We've forgotten who he was a hero to. He was a hero to former slaveholders in the South. He was defiant against people who wished to bring African Americans into politics for the first time, people who wanted to keep the Union whole. And that's what he wrote about to the press. That's how the newspapers divided when they supported him or attacked him. And his role in popular culture and in America's historical imagination is only possible because we've forgotten the politics. We've forgotten the actual substance of his letters to the press and the editorials about him.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be on the show.
T.J. Stiles is author of Jesse James, Last Rebel of the Civil War.
Now Jesse was a man, a friend to the poor, and he'd never see a man suffer pain. It was with his brother Frank, he robbed the Chicago bank and stopped the Glendale train. It was on a Saturday night, and Jesse...
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, and Megan Ryan, engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Natasha Kogonker and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Are you going to say it, Bob? Are you going to say it? Are you going to say it? Are you going to say it? Huh? Are you going to say it?
Yeehaw.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Beidel Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.